New York Mayor Bill de Blasio got elected on a progressive platform. Can he govern as a progressive too?
New York City is a very progressive city. So we had the most progressive candidate in the Democratic primary winning the general election by a nearly 50-point margin. And the media felt like, okay, he won, now let's ignore everything he said and govern from the center. But de Blasio said, no, I ran as leader of a movement. I intend to nurture that movement, to make good on the promises of that movement, and to build that movement.
That's journalist Eric Alterman. We spend most of the hour talking with him about his new book, Inequality and One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment. And then a poem or two for Poetry Month. Bill de Blasio's progressive experiment and what it means for the nation as a whole. That's on the ticket on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. When Bill de Blasio said on Meet the Press April 12th that he wasn't ready to endorse Hillary Clinton for president until she more clearly spells out her views on inequality, he attracted outrage from his own party and snide suggestions that he was being disloyal to his former boss. De Blasio ran Clinton's campaign for New York State Senator 8 years ago. It was as if the New York mayor had committed a social faux pas in choosing to place his own clearly drawn progressive agenda above the party line. De Blasio got elected promising to put an end to economic and social inequalities that, as he said, threatened to unravel the city we love. The election came as a shock to the city's establishment, but once accomplished, most assumed that de Blasio would have to give up his progressive vision and toe the centrist line. But 1 year later, he's already accomplished a good deal for that vision, surprising cynics and supporters alike. Universal pre-K is a resounding success. Workers in the city are now entitled to sick leave, and the minimum wage is likely to go up. Affordable housing units are being negotiated and built, and New York is tackling the worst abuses at the city's prison, Rikers Island. But Mayor de Blasio faces strong headwinds, a governor who seems bent on undermining him, a Republican-ruled legislature in Albany, a hostile police force, and corporate interests that are among the most powerful in the world, the moguls of Wall Street and real estate. He has to thread a difficult path that avoids alienating the powers that be while not disappointing the voters whose hopes are riding on him. In his new book, Inequality and One City, my guest, Nation columnist Eric Alterman, shows how de Blasio is putting his progressive vision into effect by using the power of city government. Like his hero, New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia from the Depression era, de Blasio wants to show not only that progressivism works, but that it's synonymous with good governance. And that, Eric Alterman says, is a message for the nation as well as the city. His book, Inequality in One City, is available as an ebook from The Nation, as well as in print on demand from Amazon.com. Eric Alterman teaches journalism at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center of Journalism. He also writes a column for The Nation and is senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Alterman is the author of 9 previous books, including the national bestseller, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias and the News. Eric Alterman, welcome to Writer's Voice. You heard Bill de Blasio give a campaign talk in the living room of a friend. What was the major message that you heard from him then, and what was your reaction to it?
Well, the major message then, which was surprising at the time, was that he thought he was going to win the Democratic primary, which very few people thought. I certainly didn't think so. And his argument had to do with the progressive nature of the primary and the fact that he was well positioned to take advantage of that. And he made a good case. I still didn't quite believe it, but he made a good case. And then I told him that whereas I like to call myself a liberal rather than a progressive, but I mean the same thing in this context, that I consider myself very liberal. I'm a columnist for The Nation. etc. But I really like how safe and clean New York City is right now, or has been. And I know a lot of people feel that way, no matter how liberal they are. And he was going to get slammed on going back to the olden days, and how was he going to respond to that? And he had an answer ready for that. And he talked about the signaling to people by who he would appoint as police commissioner and other things that they could feel safe. I don't mean safe physically. I mean safe knowing that he understood this concern, that nobody wanted to go back to the bad old days, and that it was important that if he was going to govern as a liberal, that he do all the things that people expect from a mayor before they get involved in ideological issues.
So you didn't think he was going to win then, and I want to come back to some of that issue of safety. The media narrative, and you write a lot about the media itself and how they construct narratives, and yes. I think this is just an incredible example, really, of maybe the disconnect between a media narrative and reality in some ways.
Oh, I agree.
So talk about what their narrative was around the campaign, and then how it shifted, or has it shifted since then?
Good question. Well, like many people, I wasn't following the campaign until it got serious, and I didn't even think there was going to be a pain. I thought Christine Quinn had the election wrapped up. I thought if you take Michael Bloomberg, who people thought he was doing a good job, and you throw in the first female and first gay mayor, that was a done deal in a Democratic primary. But what I didn't understand at the time, I had an inkling of this, but I didn't get it, is how the disjunction between the media view of Michael Bloomberg and everyday people's view of Michael Bloomberg. And whereas many in the media, particularly the elite media, were thrilled with Bloomberg and thrilled with what a lovely city he created for those of us lucky enough to be able to afford it, that millions of people felt like the city was being taken away from them. Mm-hmm. And that the disparities in income, the nurturing of the 1% of the 1%, not just the 1%, but the 1% of the 1%, was offensive to people, but also was destroying the fabric of the city. And de Blasio understood that in a way that both I and most people in the mainstream media did not. So he was able to ride that issue to the top of the pack. And Quinn, being seen as a stand-in for de Blasio, lost her ability to respond. I mean, stand-in for Bloomberg, lost her ability to respond because she would have had to repudiate the person everybody understood that she had been supporting all this time. Mm. Kind of like the position Hubert Humphrey was in with Lyndon Johnson in 1968.
Say more about that for those of our listeners who weren't around at that time.
Well, Hubert Humphrey would have probably been president in 1968 had he repudiated the Vietnam War. But he couldn't repudiate the Vietnam War because he was a vice president to the president who had ramped up the Vietnam War and made it his signature issue. And so he was kind of stuck. If he had repudiated it, it would have seemed like he didn't have any values. So he was stuck with this very unpopular thing. And it turned out that the inequality-related policies of Michael Bloomberg were the same kind of stone around Christine Quinn's neck.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Eric Alterman about his book, Inequality in One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment, Year One. So he hasn't had the best relationship with the media. He's been a bit resistant to it. Also, it's been a two-way street. But he's also, you point out in your book, that he's been able to use social media in a way that is unusual for politicians, and it's been very effective. Say more about, what do you mean by that?
Well, the first thing we should point out, one fascinating thing about his victory in the Democratic primary is that Christine Quinn got the endorsement of all three major dailies, the New York Times, the New York Post, and the Daily News, and still did not even cross, I think, 20% threshold, which is amazing. And it demonstrates the colossal fall, for lack of a better word, in the influence of the mainstream media in our politics. That de Blasio could have won a Democratic primary without even, just the New York Times should have been good enough. So that's fascinating. Now, the tabloid media don't like de Blasio at all.
And why? One of the things you point out is that they're very connected in with the real estate industry.
Yeah. Well, Mort Zuckerman, who owns the Daily News, is a real estate baron. So is the owner of the New York Observer, which is far less important. And Rupert Murdoch is a right-wing ideologue who hates anyone who talks about redistribution. Now, in fact, de Blasio is actually pretty popular with a lot of real estate people. But Zuckerman represents the conservative wing of the Democratic Party, and de Blasio represents the progressive wing. So those people are always at war with one another. I would say the New York Times has warmed to de Blasio. And I think their coverage is actually excellent. I find fault with it. There are some stories which I think were silly. But if someone read the New York Times every day, they would have a pretty good idea of what's going on. Whereas the tabloid coverage in the Post and the Daily News is quite hostile and sometimes ridiculous. The coverage of the horse carriage issue in the Daily News is actually comical.
And say what that was for, because not all our listeners are in New York.
It's funny. If you read the New York Daily News, which used to be the largest circulation paper in all of the United States, you would think that the most important issue facing New York City is whether or not we're going to have horse-drawn carriages in Central Park or electric-driven carriages. They literally ran hundreds of stories on this topic and ginned up the public with demonstrations and petitions and so forth. And it's a nutty thing. With the case of the New York Post, it's just outright hostility to anyone liberal. But as I said, de Blasio, number one, he's been able to forge a relationship with the New York Times. But more importantly, he's been able to go around and above or below the mainstream media using social media. And his advisors are very clear that there is no one way to communicate anymore. There used to be a few avenues of communication. There used to be pundits in New York City who people looked to as kind of surrogates for themselves. Names like Murray Kempton, Sidney Shanberg, Jack Newfield, Jimmy Breslin, Pete Hamill. Everybody remembers these people who grew up reading them. There's nobody like that today at all. And everybody gets their news catch as catch can, and the de Blasio people understand that, and they are communicating at every possible level, and thereby further diminishing the power of the mainstream media.
There's another aspect to de Blasio's election and the kind of cluelessness, if I can use such an extreme term, for the media, and that is how he was connected into a kind of movement politics that they seem to be blind to.
Well, the media don't like movements of any kind because they like to be able to say, on the one hand, the left says this, and on the other hand, the right says this, and that makes whatever I'm saying correct. But New York City is a very progressive city. So we had the most progressive candidate in the Democratic primary winning the general election by a nearly 50-point margin. And the media felt like, okay, he won, now let's ignore everything he said and govern from the center. But de Blasio said, no, I ran as leader of a movement. I intend to nurture that movement, to make good on the promises of that movement, and to build that movement. And this is anathema to most reporters. Except reporters who happen to be invested in this movement. So they really don't know what to make of it. It's true. And this is actually, I said that I thought that coverage of the New York Times was pretty good, but this is actually one area where they've fallen down on the job because on the one hand, they complain that de Blasio appoints too many liberals to positions rather than bureaucrats. And on the other hand, they say, oh, but look, the liberals are complaining that he's not doing enough. Well, actually, the liberals have been pretty patient with de Blasio because they feel they can trust him. And so he's been able to put the interests of the larger community first in order to be able to accomplish his liberal or progressive goals. And I think that's been the secret of his success so far. I think he's in very good shape politically for the future, and it's because fundamentally he understands that he's got to keep the city safe and clean, and he's got to keep the budget in good shape, and he's got to promote economic growth, and then he can do the things he really believes in about inequality. And so far, that's what's happened. I mean, cops have been a problem and so forth, and charter schools were a big problem. But by and large, he's been quite competent in the pragmatic aspects of the job. And he's also pursued his goals rather pragmatically, too. I'm very impressed. There are a lot of politicians who I've felt more invested in personally than de Blasio. I've been writing about politics for over 30 years now. I don't feel a deep connection to him, but I'm very impressed by the way he's pursued his progressive goals in a way I haven't really seen anybody do in my lifetime.
And if you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Eric Alterman about his new book about Bill de Blasio, his first year in office. It's called Inequality in One City. I want to get to those points because that's the meat of the book, is how he's dealing with the issue of inequality. But since you brought up the cops and you talked about how liberals trust him, I actually don't vote in the city. I live out on Long Island also, so I was sad I couldn't vote for de Blasio, but I spend many months during the year here, and I was shocked and quite uneasy, I think, when he put in Bill Bratton as his almost first appointment. Mm-hmm. And I understand that he did that to reassure people that he was going to keep a safe city, but the issue of broken windows, I mean, basically, Bill de Blasio has come under attack from both left and right when it comes around to the police issue. And many people point to the fact that arrests have actually gone up under the broken windows policy under Bill de Blasio for small crimes. This is the same kind of crime, the same kind of arrest that led to the death of Eric Garner, although that, of course, was not under Bill de Blasio's watch.
Well, these are very complicated issues, both politically and on the ground. It's true that, I mean, I am very skeptical about broken windows myself. But whereas small arrests may have gone up, stop and frisk was ended. And marijuana arrests are now going to be done very differently. And those were the things that were most oppressive to poor neighborhoods and to people of color, who lived a life in New York City that the rest of us can't even imagine. I looked it up recently. Between 2008 and 2012, there were 2 million stop and frisk incidents in New York City. 90% people of color, 90% innocent people. And when the courts stopped stop and frisk, then they ratcheted up the marijuana arrests. And a marijuana arrest for a young kid puts you in the system and can ruin your life because you have to put it on job applications and college applications and so forth. And it's very, I don't know if the intent is racist, but the effect is racist because I grew up in the days of people smoking pot all the time and nobody I knew ever went to jail or had it ruin their life. It's only poor people that this happens to, and frequently poor people of color who live in. This is an effect of what's called spatial inequality, that because these people live in a certain neighborhood, they are victimized by inequality and criminal justice issues. So he has tried to address that, and he will continue to try and address that. The problem is, there's some issues where right and left can both attack you, but only one of them matters. And it matters a lot if the cops attack you and don't cooperate with you. It doesn't matter so much if Al Sharpton doesn't like you in this case. It's actually kind of useful if Al Sharpton doesn't like you. So de Blasio, he has to tend to his constituency, which is people who are victimized and suspicious of the police in these cases. He can't lose that. But first order of business is to make sure that the cops don't undermine his entire mayoralty, which they could. So that's why he appointed Bratton, because Bratton had the trust of the police and the trust of the public. And that's why he is being very generous to the police. And that's why even when they were engaging in civil disobedience, he waited them out. And that turned out to be the successful thing to do. I finished the book January 7th, it was due, and the police were still turning their backs on him at funerals. But now that issue's gone away. And he's made a deal with every police union except one, the one run by the recalcitrant Mr. Lynch, who is now being challenged in his own union. So he ended up handling that very well, even though if you read the New York Times and the Daily News, you would have thought the apocalypse was here.
Mm. And yet broken windows is also a racist policy in its effect and can be devastating and is contributing to the development of a movement that's pretty powerful. So maybe he doesn't care about Al Sharpton, but I'm not so sure he doesn't care.
I think it's an issue he will approach over time. But he's not ready to do it yet. And he can't do it with Bratton in there. And he can't lose Bratton. So that's that.
Well, this actually is a very interesting discussion to have as a preface to talking about the way he deals with inequality.
Before we leave this issue, mm-hmm. Look at how Barack Obama deals with the CIA and the national security establishment. There are certain things that liberals and progressives have to do when dealing with real force and real power in society, and they may not like it, but there's just no alternative. If there were a really strong movement to overturn these policies,
that had a majority support, that would be different. But these, the police in New York City and the military and national security, CIA, in national politics are more powerful than any of their opponents. And if you go up against them, they can destroy your administration. So you don't do it.
And this is a great way to actually talk about the issue of inequality, what Bill de Blasio wants to do, is trying to do, and is working on, and the barriers that he faces. Very much structural barriers. This is really a book, I think, about power, and how do you exercise power on the behalf of those who have been relatively powerless once you get into office and you're up against more entrenched, powerful interests.
Thank you. That was very well put. I published a book in 2010 called Kabuki Democracy, The System Versus Barack Obama, where I argued that no president could put into effect Barack Obama's campaign promises because the system was structured in such a way to frustrate liberal initiatives, the national system. And it didn't matter how liberal Barack Obama was in his heart, even though we couldn't know that. That's not true at the metropolitan level. A mayor of New York City, there are a lot of frustrating aspects to his job, particularly taxation policy lying in Albany and also federal government funding issues. But the mayor can actually do quite a lot. And de Blasio is doing quite a lot. As long as he has the support of the city council, which he does, he can enact policies that directly affect people's lives on the ground in a way a president can't. And so I argue in the conclusion of the book that he's actually enacting a new paradigm of governance, which is if you deliver services to the people who need them, they will vote for you. We haven't seen that before. I mean, maybe we saw it in the New Deal or under Phil LaGuardia, but our politics have been conducted at sort of a meta level until now, in the media and arguments over terms and so forth. Remember, Rudy Giuliani was really upset about Piss Christ. It was all symbolic.
That's when there was a painting that had, I guess,
it was soaked in urine. It was a Jesus. It was a crucifix soaked in urine, and it was hung at the Brooklyn Museum. And you wouldn't believe how much attention was devoted to it. But de Blasio is saying, I'm going to deliver 55,000 pre-K spots to 55,000 families of four-year-olds. I'm going to do it 3 years in a row. That makes 155,000 people, depending on how many kids they have. I'm going to expand the coverage of sick leave and of minimum wage for people who work with city contracts. I'm going to expand after school. I'm going to expand Wi-Fi coverage. I'm going to help people get back in the system after they've experienced arrest. I'm going to do all these things for all these people who have traditionally been ignored because they've been relatively powerless in the system, and then find a way to convince them to participate in politics in a way they haven't before. It's a little bit risky, but it's a test of the ability of our democracy to be responsive.
And in fact, one way he's talked about doing that, and he's made clear that he wants to do it, is by incorporating inequality in many different aspects of governing. He convened a kind of retreat that you talk about in the book, Eric Altman, that you talk about an inequality in one city, where he brought together many different agencies and had them working in a very different way.
He did do that. But more importantly, after he did that, that was done under the authority of the first deputy mayor, Anthony Shores. But after he did that, he then instructed every single city agency to, in their semi-annual report, I forget what it's called at the moment, to have a section of how they are improving inequality in the city, how they are addressing inequality. So no matter what the agency is, they have the task now of addressing inequality. Now, this is actually the most interesting and most important thing that I learned in writing this book, which is that economic inequality has enormous breadth. It covers an enormous array of issues and problems that people don't normally associate with it. I've been writing about inequality for a very long time at the national level, but until I really began to study it for this book, I had no idea of all of the different kinds of impacts it has. Bill de Blasio, and I asked him this, and he didn't really give me an answer that I understood, but he understood this without studying, and he just knew it from his experience in politics. And he charged every single agency and every single person in the government with thinking about how to address this. So all across the board, this issue is being addressed. And that's appropriate, because that was the basis of his campaign. That was the single issue that he made. That he said, vote for me if you care about this issue. Nobody else said that.
Could you give us some examples of things that you learned that
I have one example that drives me crazy. It has to do with spatial inequality. So spatial inequality means that if you live in an isolated place, you end up suffering a great deal more than you would with the exact same income if you lived in a more centrally located place, because you have far fewer services and the services are more expensive and spread out and more difficult to get to, and they end up eating a lot more of your time and money and taking away from your ability to work and your ability to spend time with your family. So the one statistic that I really found shocking, and I tell people that they usually find it shocking too, which is that pregnant women who have babies living under conditions of spatial inequality, their babies have smaller brains than women living outside of these conditions because of the stress that they experience during pregnancy. And that stress affects the brain size of their kids. So these babies are born at a disadvantage from the minute they're born because of economic inequality. They could win the lottery the next day and they would still be at a disadvantage against everyone else. That's one example, but there's lots and lots of examples like that.
And what is something that Bill de Blasio, as mayor of New York, could do to correct that issue?
Well, here's something that he is doing, which is he's doubling the number of what are called community schools. Community schools are schools that become neighborhood hubs for all kinds of services that families need. So instead of a family having to go to 18 places to get dental care or mental health care or physical health care or legal aid or counseling of some sort or intervention, any kind of intervention, all those services are located at a certain time and place in the school that their kids attend. And that gives them much more access to it and frees up time and also gives people services that they otherwise wouldn't receive. Mm. And they're very expensive, these schools. So they take a big investment, but he's investing in them.
Journalist Eric Alterman. We'll talk more with him after the break about his book, Inequality and One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment, Year One. Don't go away.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it. New York, New York. These vagabond shoes, they are longing to stray right through the very heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in a city that doesn't sleep and find that chaos.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. There's a fight brewing over the soul of the Democratic Party. It's between the party's center-right establishment, typified by Hillary Clinton, and the party's progressive wing, represented by Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, both of whom have made America's high and growing economic inequality the touchstone of their work. And while the centrists have begun paying lip service to concerns about inequality lately, it's too early to tell whether their record will match their rhetoric. One politician who does seem determined to align his record with his rhetoric is New York Mayor Bill de Blasio. It's been a little over a year since his election, and my guest this hour, Eric Alterman, has a fascinating book out that looks at that record of year one. De Blasio ran on a platform of bringing more economic and social equality to the city's residents. Alterman says that to many people's surprise, including his own, de Blasio is on track to enact his platform, or at least a good chunk of it. His crowning achievement to date is the successful rollout of universal pre-K, despite New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's opposition to de Blasio's plan to make it permanently funded by a tax on the city's wealthiest residents. Cuomo nixed that tax and funded only 3 years of universal pre-K, but the de Blasio administration is confident that that is enough to ensure the program's long-term stability. But can de Blasio's progressive program outlast his administration, even if he does make real headway in correcting some of the worst impacts of inequality during it? And what does his approach, using the mechanisms of government itself to effect change, mean for the country at large? Those are some issues we take up in the second half of today's show in our conversation with Eric Alterman about his book, Inequality and One City. So let's talk about education. That was, aside from stopping stop and frisk, bringing universal pre-K and a lesser-known program, free after school, was a very, main plank of his platform when he was a candidate. As you said, he has brought in universal pre-K to expand it to 50,000 students, four-year-olds, for 3 years. I have a quick question about that. For 3 years, that's the funding he got. He was not able to get a dedicated income stream by a minor, price of one latte per day on millionaire's tax to assure that universal pre-K would remain forever. So what happens at the end of 3 years?
I don't think, given how successfully the program was rolled out and how celebrated it was, I don't think it's possible to take it away. Personally, I've talked to de Blasio's advisors about this. Personally, I think he always knew he was never going to get that tax. I thought it was symbolically important for him to say, I'm willing to tax rich people, because liberals have been afraid to say that. And this tiny little tax, I don't think it was ever going to happen, because Andrew Cuomo, his whole political persona is he doesn't want to tax rich people. So Cuomo was never going to give in. But interestingly, very few people took seriously how serious de Blasio was about getting this program. The Daily News had to issue an out-front apology for how wrong they had been in saying that it would never happen. And when he first went to see Cuomo about it, and Cuomo offered him only 1 year, everyone said, take it, including the New York Times editorial board. And he said, no, I need to establish this program. 1 year is not enough. I need at least 3 years. He got 3 years, $300 million. And I think 3 years means you can't take it away, even though he didn't get the tax, which, again, I think he was never going to get, and he probably knew that.
So Cuomo humiliated or tried to humiliate de Blasio by coming out in great support for the charter school movement. I'd like to ask you about the relationship between the two. You know, there are so many things, as much as he can do with the city council, you point out in your book, Eric Alterman, in Inequality in One City, that there's a lot that de Blasio, the mayor, cannot do because the reins of power are in the state government. And you have a Governor Cuomo who is, on the surface, a Democrat. He's a social liberal, but in other ways, he really reigns with the Republicans in the legislature. So talk about the challenges that de Blasio faces, the structural political challenges.
Sure. Well, first of all, many in the media tend to use a shorthand of centrist for Andrew Cuomo, but he's not a centrist at all. He's a social liberal and an economic conservative. And he's particularly conservative with regard to taxation policy. So anything that adversely affects wealthy people, he's not going to like. Now, charter schools, which is the issue that came to the fore where he stabbed de Blasio in the back, really on camera, that's the issue that has the most rich people behind it. The single biggest contribution to Albany politicians in the 2014 election cycle was from supporters of charter schools.
Hedge fund managers.
Yeah, it's a favorite cause of hedge funds, even more than the real estate industry, charter schools. So Cuomo was never going to go against them. And he taught de Blasio a lesson, which is, I will stab you in the back if you make my life too difficult. So de Blasio, I'm very impressed by this. I would never do this. De Blasio has allowed Cuomo to humiliate him and has turned the other cheek and has taken it over and over. And he went to bat for Cuomo with the Working Families Party, and the same thing happened again. And yet he still says, look, my job as mayor is to do the best I can for New York City, and that involves working with the governor. And if I can't do that, I can't get anything done. So he's willing to have people say he looks bad, he looks weak, he doesn't understand power the way Andrew Cuomo does, because if he crossed Cuomo in a more public way, the city would be punished for it. So, like I said, I'm impressed by it. I don't obviously approve of what Cuomo does, but it's a given. You know, Cuomo's quite popular too. Well, actually, he's not that popular, but he just won re-election, so he's not going anywhere. He's actually quite unpopular now, but that doesn't matter because he's actually kind of a brilliant politician, I think. He's quite similar to Lyndon Johnson in that nobody likes him, but people fear him, and he gets things done. So de Blasio has no choice but to work with Cuomo and to pretend to like it, and he's done a good job.
So how can he, I mean, you pointed out ways in which he can achieve a redistributive program, because when we talk about inequality, we're talking about distribution of the wealth, basically. If Cuomo and state government will not give him anything he needs, when you know, are basically saying hands off on redistribution of the wealth, what are the forces that can help promote de Blasio's agenda on this? I mean, the Working Families Party, you just mentioned them. They were a huge impact on getting him elected, but they also went out for Cuomo against Zephyr Teachout, who had, been going against Cuomo. Well,
that was thanks to de Blasio that they did that. He negotiated that deal. Yeah. And I think it was probably the right thing to do from the standpoint of the best interests of the city. Now, look, Cuomo, he still needs to identify as a Democrat. And he still understands that inequality is the most important issue for Democrats. So he is willing to make compromises when he feels it's in their interest, in his interest. So, for instance, one compromise it seems like he's willing to make is to allow New York City to have a higher minimum wage than the rest of the state. It's not as high as de Blasio would like it. De Blasio would like to have the highest minimum wage in the whole country. But he's moved on that issue. De Blasio's focus on this has moved him on this issue. And he will move on other issues. He won't take a big bite out of the wealthiest people's incomes in the city, but he might take some small bites. Because very wealthy people understand that they've had a great ride for the past, since 2008, and they can afford a little bit of give. A good example we haven't talked about is housing policy. There's an enormous amount of money to be made in Manhattan and also in Brooklyn now in the housing market in New York City. You know, there's almost all the apartments being built now are $5 million or more. Mm-hmm. Apartments for $25 million are not even that rare. So under Michael Bloomberg, if you wanted a tax abatement under the 421 program, you had to build 80-20, 80% affordable and 80% unaffordable. 80% whatever market rate, and 20% quote-unquote affordable. Affordable is defined as affordable to a person making between $35,000 and $100,000. So it sounds like a lot of money to people, but in New York, it's not a lot of money. Anyway, de Blasio, he hasn't put an actual figure on how much he wants to increase this by, but it looks like he's gunning for 27% rather than 20%, which is a big jump. It's a 33% jump in what you're demanding from the developers. So he's offering the developers the opportunity to make money in other ways, to make their buildings denser and taller, and to offer them certain services that they wouldn't otherwise get, and to be flexible about where the apartments are, actually. And the point here is that the real estate industry is okay with all this because they're still making a fortune. And they understand that in order to keep things smooth, they've got to give a little more, and they are.
Then there's the issue of infrastructure. And I have to say, when I read your book, I knew that New York City was in an infrastructure crisis. I didn't realize it was as bad as it is. Tell us a little bit about this crisis, which has been going on for at least 50 years, that we've been in an infrastructure emergency. And what can de Blasio do about that? And how can that affect inequality?
Well, the city's infrastructure crisis is like its housing crisis. It's perennial. And also, the city's infrastructure crisis is like the country's infrastructure crisis. The country, I believe, from the Army Corps of Engineers or whoever, or not the Army Corps of Engineers, but the Society of Engineers, whatever they call themselves, got a D+ on its infrastructure. And the city is in similarly bad shape at best. But de Blasio understands this. The thing is, infrastructure has no constituency. I was very impressed when I interviewed de Blasio and I said the city needs $50 billion of infrastructure investment, according to some study, above what's planned for. And he said 47.3, and that was actually the exact figure that was called for. He said 47, and I said, well, actually 47.3, but still, I'm impressed. The thing about infrastructure is, again, it has no constituency, and B, it's hard to do because you need workers for it. And right now, the city, particularly in the construction industry, is at full employment. The construction people are paying a fortune. They can't get workers just because of the real estate boom. So it's actually not a good time to have the New Deal that I would like to see, because you can't get trained workers. You'd have to invest in training workers, and you'd have to rethink the whole process. So both First Deputy Mayor Shores and Bill de Blasio, the mayor, are cognizant of this crisis and would like to address it, but they're giving themselves some time. And they will make a dent in it. It will never go away, just like the housing crisis will never go away.
Where's the money going to come from to do this? Because you're not just talking about infrastructure, updating what is going bad, but you're also talking about resilience and dealing with climate change and rising sea levels. That's going to also take at least $50 billion, according to what some of the figures that came out under the previous administration. So where is the money going to come from? It doesn't seem to come from the federal government or even the state.
Well, some of it will have to come from the federal government and from the state. And some of it will have to come from borrowing on the basis of these being good investments for the city. Mm-hmm. I mean, the $47.3 billion figure, that is what's given, I think it's the Center for an Urban Future. That's the name of the group that did the study. But that's just to keep New York City at the level of being the leading economic power in the country, to provide the infrastructure the city that business needs to keep going. So these additional costs, you're right, they're there, and there's no way the city can address it by themselves. But so long as the economic atmosphere stays healthy, and it's very healthy now, de Blasio's budgets have been very good because, and due to the real estate business more than anything, he can continue to up the investment in this and affect it gradually. Again, it's never going to be solved.
Bill de Blasio, Fiorella LaGuardia, the mayor of New York during the 1930s, during the previous Depression, is his model. Now, that was a time of great social movements, and it seems like we might be going into a time of social movements again. How do you see civil society being able to support de Blasio in his agenda going forward?
This is an area where I disagree with de Blasio. He would agree with you. And I don't. I think our movement in civil society is very weak. I think it's been particularly weakened under Bloomberg, who gave a lot of money to these organizations and made them dependent on that funding and therefore unwilling to challenge him. And also, people are too busy trying to make a living, by and large. Most people, I don't think, are very political. New York's a little bit different than other places. It is a more political place, and we have a much bigger union presence than other places, so it's never going to quite go away. But I think he'd be crazy to depend on these organizations to go up against the real estate industry, for instance. I mean, you saw there was a nascent movement about the cops, and then these guys got assassinated, and everybody said, okay, forget about that. We haven't got time to worry about that. We need to assure the safety of the cops. The cops were much, much stronger. Mm-hmm. And some of that will come back a little bit. But they can't really threaten the power of these organizations. Part of that is the problem of money in politics, you know, that the guys who pay for the campaigns are the people who call the tunes. Now, in New York City, we have a very good law, which is part of the reason de Blasio was able to get elected. With great matching law, I think it's 6-1. So that if you raise a certain amount, you can get 6 times as much back in funding, so that there's no great advantage to raising a lot of money, because there's a ceiling on that. It didn't work with Bloomberg. It doesn't work with a billionaire, but it works in a regular race like de Blasio was in. But I don't know. The Working Families Party, some of these organizations, they have some vibrancy to them. But I wouldn't bet on them as a means of power. Now, de Blasio, maybe because he has to say this, we argued about this. And he thinks that there's a historic movement that's never gone away, and it's coming back, and it'll be very inspirational. And, you know, if that were true, Barack Obama would be in a lot better shape than he is. I think people, you know, they've lost faith in politics, number one. And number two, money has strangled our ability to have popular pressure. Money is so much more powerful than people in our politics now that I'm just, a cynic about this. But so, I'd be happy to be proved wrong.
So do you feel that de Blasio basically is only going to be able to tinker around the edges because there is movement?
That's the wrong way to look at it. What de Blasio has going for him is not the movement. He's got the city government. Mm-hmm. City government is very big and powerful. Mm-hmm. According to one estimate I was given, it affects directly 20% of the incomes in New York City. So like I said, with housing, he can say to developers, if you want to make all this money, you're going to have to cough up an additional 33% of your apartments for affordable housing. And they're doing it because they can't build without the permission of the city and the zoning laws and so forth. So he has all kinds of regulations and laws and lots of money, you know, billions of dollars to invest in order to make the city a fairer place. He can't end inequality. He maybe can't even make a dent in what's called the Gini coefficient, which is how you measure the distribution of wealth in a society. He probably can't do that. But he can give a lot of people the tools they need to pull themselves up in the world.
We're talking with journalist Eric Alterman about his book, Inequality in One City, Bill de Blasio and the New York Experiment. Well, one thing is affordable housing, and that's largely for the middle class, people who can't afford, you know, between, as you say, 30,000 and 100,000 a year, people who make that amount. But you also talk in the book about NYCHA, about New York City Housing Authority, which houses, an enormous number of people.
3 million people. But actually, I think a better example is the welfare agency. Mm-hmm. This is, the best symbol of the change between Bloomberg and de Blasio. Bloomberg appointed a guy to run that agency who is now moved on to the American Enterprise Institute, a right-wing think tank, whereas de Blasio appointed to head that agency a guy who was head, who had been, for the past 10 years, head of the Legal Aid Society, in charge of suing the city on behalf of the clients of the agency. And he'd worked there for 30 years. And this guy just went in and turned the whole place upside down and said, from now on, we're not serving ourselves, we're serving these people, and I'm changing all of these laws and regulations so that we can serve people who are getting assistance, who are the victims of domestic abuse, who are need drug treatment, et cetera, who need job training. And it's been a night and day change. And I'm so impressed by this because these people have no political power. They probably don't even vote. They certainly don't go to dinner parties with the editorial board of the New York Times. And yet people don't care in the administration. They're there. They've completely flipped the purpose of this agency. They've given them different marching orders. And they're not very politically astute marching orders, but they are consistent with the vision of reducing inequality in the city and helping the people who need help the most.
So looking ahead, I mean, this book covers the first year of de Blasio's administration, but at most he's got two terms. I don't think he can pull what Bloomberg did in getting a third term. Can he make long-term change that cannot be undone? I mean, maybe he can with universal pre-K, but your book covers transportation and infrastructure and housing and policing and, you know, the courts. We haven't even really talked about that in the prisons and some of the efforts to reform what's going on out in Rikers Island. How can the changes he make outlast his administration?
Well, they have to work. If they work, then there's no reason to change them. I mean, there's a crisis at Rikers right now, and Rikers has to be fundamentally remade because it's a failure, the prison. But if Rikers were being well-run and there were no crisis there, there'd be no pressure to change it. Same with pre-K. If it's working, you can't get rid of it. All these things. So what he has to do is do these things carefully and competently, and then the change is there because people won't want to go back.
And do you think that he can change the larger narrative about progressives as good administrators. You know, the narrative so long in this country has been, you have to be, if you're a businessman, you're going to be a good manager.
Well, one of the arguments of this book is that Mayor Bloomberg was a much worse mayor than we knew, and that he was given credit for all kinds of things that he was actually a failure at. 100% failure with regard to Sandy and helping people, 100% failure at Rikers, not even so good on economic development. So I think de Blasio making all those things job one, competence and making sure that things are done right. I was surprised at how well the rollout of pre-K went. I thought there were going to be a lot more problems. I kept saying to them, what's going to happen when some guy you hire in kindergarten turns out to be a child molester or something? How are you going to handle that? They said, look, we know we're going to have problems, but we're giving 55,000 families pre-K. These kids are only going to be 4 years old once. If we did a pilot program, like a lot of people suggest, then they would never get the chance. So we'll deal with the problems as they come up. But they were so conscientious about all the various issues, fire safety, you know, the backgrounds of the teachers, the teacher training, reaching people, you know, and all these languages that people speak in New York City, it's hard to reach people. They did a really great job. So that's a model. And I, you know, the Daily News ate its words, the New York Times ate some of its words, and I swallowed a lot of my misgivings. I was very impressed. So they know what they're doing. Things will go wrong. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the most important thing he can do nationally is prove that progressive governance is possible again, because in the 60s, liberal governance was discredited. Nobody looks back and says we need the Lindsay administration again, even though the Lindsay administration did a lot of good things, because it was overwhelmed by its failures, just like Lyndon Johnson's administration was. So de Blasio is rebuilding that model on a municipal level. And I'm very pleased to see that, because I think it's right now it's the only hope for progressive change in this country.
Well, Eric Alterman, I urge all our listeners to get this book. It's only in e-format at this time.
You can order it as a paperback on demand, either from Nation eBooks or from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, whatever.
And it's a fascinating study, and I think one with great relevance, not just to New York City, but the entire nation. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Eric Alterman teaches journalism at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Find a link to his ebook, Inequality in One City, at writersvoice.net, as well as links to some of his columns on Bill de Blasio for The Nation magazine. April is Poetry Month. Sometimes books of poetry are sent to me, often poets I don't know of. A recent book I received is the poetry volume After the Rain by poet and builder Jonathan Wright, who writes and builds in Western Massachusetts. Here's one of the poems from the book that brings the promise of summer from the midst of spring. It's called Calendula. Calendula, spring flood abated, and silted wood's floor sprung with fiddleheads, ripples of light and yellow-blossomed calendula, an almanac of undulated days between planting moons. Calendula, the salve for babies in their first spring, the restless bark and bakery of cinnamon and turbinado. Calendula, early flower, flourishing like Cold Creek salmon fry before the maple's leaf. Calendula, flickering candle with endless cotton wicks. Calendula, the pendulum of Scotland swings in Caledonia. Calendula, between breaths you rest on the tip of the edge of the river of my tongue, then are swallowed, thirsty, dark, dredged with petals and duff into summer. What a lovely poem. That was Calendula by poet Jonathan Wright, published in his book After the Rain. Another wonderful poet who lives in Western Massachusetts, and one of my favorites, is former U.S. Poet Laureate Richard Wilbur. We spoke to him several years ago in his home in Cummington, Massachusetts. He read us his poem, Advice to a Prophet.
Advice to a Prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun, mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy. The lark avoid the reaches of our eye. The jackpine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth, when that lie of tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
Advice to a Prophet, read by poet Richard Wilbur. Here's another by him. I love this poem. It's called A Barred Owl.
When I read this to an audience, I always remind them that a good many of them will already understand that what the barred owl says when it cries out in the woods at night is, "Who cooks for you?" A barred owl. The warping night air having brought the boom of an owl's voice into her darkened room. We tell the wakened child that all she heard was an odd question from a forest bird, asking of us, if rightly listened to, "Who cooks for you?" And then, "Who cooks for you?" Words which can make our terrors bravely clear can also thus domesticate a fear and send a small child back to sleep at night, not listening for the sound of stealthy flight or dreaming of some small thing in a claw borne up to some dark branch and eaten raw.
Barred Owl, read by Richard Wilbur. You can hear our interview with him and more poetry read by him by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.